A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The New Statesman.
To Southend Central, calling at West Ham, Barking, Upminster, Ockenden, Chafford Hundred, Grays, Tilbury Town, East Tilbury, Stamford Le Hope.
I've just left Fenchurch Street Station and I'm headed for Grays Town Centre in the borough of Thurrock, Essex. Now, we're recording this episode of Westminster Reimagined here because it's a borough which is suffering major cuts to all its council services after it went effectively bankrupt last December. Hundreds of millions of pounds were put into risky investments that didn't pay off. It's a symptom of austerity, which included major local authority cuts since 2010, as well as poor management. But what really caught my eye when I went to report from Grays back in August were the cuts to a place called Thameside, an arts complex, described locally as a mini Barbican, which houses a theatre, library, archive and museum. It got me thinking about something Armando and I have been discussing a while planning this series. What happened to the good life and happiness and the things that make our lives enriching in UK politics? Why is everything seen through the lens of a balance book rather than what is best for our long-term well-being and joy? We've just arrived outside the Thameside, and just to bring it to life for our listeners, it's a very concrete building with sort of brickwork on the side. You can kind of see why they call it a mini Barbican, because the concrete really does dominate. And you can see adverts on the outside of it for Black History Month and the panto Jack and the Beanstalk and Aladdin as well. So you can see that some of the culture is still going on inside, but the outdoor cafe terrace, there's no chairs or plant pots on there anymore because the cafe closed in 2020 and it hasn't reopened. And we'll find out more when we go inside. I'm joined now by Sam Byrne, a Thurrock local and part of the Save Your Thameside campaign, and Neil Woodbridge, chief executive of the social enterprise Thurrock Lifestyle Solutions, which is based in this building, and it's an organisation which supports people with learning disabilities living in Grays. And joining us down the line from LSE, we have Professor Richard Layard, economist, author, Labour peer and co-editor of the World Happiness Report, which ranks countries according to how happy they are, also known as New Labour's happiness czar when he advised Tony Blair's government. Today we're here to discuss the good life. How much value do we put on happiness in Britain? How can government policy boost happiness, and is it possible to quantify personal well-being? Places like Thameside often serve as the heart and soul of our communities. They bring people together, foster a sense of belonging, and contribute to our overall well-being. But what happens when these vital services face budget cuts? Today, government funding cuts are an unfortunate reality across the country. Often, the decision to cut funding for community services is made as part of a broader policy agenda. And in the case of Thurrock Council's funding, this is something we'll revisit later on in the conversation. But what's the impact on our communities when these centres are forced to close their doors? So Sam, I mean, we spoke in August when I first read about the story of Thameside's potential closure. Why are you fighting to save it?
Because it's such a massive part of our community. I mean, we're talking about the Thameside complex as a whole. And we've got the library, we've got the museum, it's, you know, our education, our heritage. We have the theatre. And there's so many other things that go on in this building. It really is a beacon at the middle of Thurrock for arts and culture. And we must stop them from closing it.
And why, Neil, do you think this is something that the council has had its eye on? Why are these kind of things seen as somehow inessential, the first things to go?
I think there's a problem in so much as the council assumes that there are essential services such as your bin collection. but they don't understand that arts and culture really are what defines people's happiness ultimately and can support people in coming together and the sense of well-being that happens in the community.
And Sam, actually, when we spoke, it was interesting because I asked you about other things that were being cut and sort of other costs that were going up in the community. Council tax has risen already by 10%. And you mentioned the bins as well, but you didn't want to focus on that.
No.
You wanted to talk about Thameside.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, we have this kind of balance sheet culture in this country, don't we, where it's people are moving things around in a spreadsheet and the things that perhaps are most important to people's lives are the first things that get dropped. So why is it this, you know, why is this the beacon of your campaign?
Because it represents everything about this community. I mean, this community in Thurrock is, you know, a proud, hardworking community and everything is being taken away from them. Arts and culture is so incredibly important. I think that potentially the current, you know, councillors and the council think that it's an easy cut to get rid of this, but it represents so much and actually gives such super benefit to the community from, you know, babes in arms right through to octogenarians that we've had come here for various events and various, it's not just about the theatre. There's so much more that goes on and it's all about bringing community together. It's about community and what it means and the longevity of the impact of taking something like this away from us is very short-sighted if you're going to get rid of it now.
And tell me what it brings to people, because your own daughter has benefited from coming here as a child. We've just heard some children doing a Hamlet musical down the corridor, rehearsals for that. People go on to be in the arts. And for children in Thurrock, that's not necessarily a given.
No, absolutely. And I think that that's absolutely right. Lots of people have performed on this stage that are now performing in the West End and across Europe. But it's not just about giving children, well, every part of our community, but certainly if you look at young children, that opportunity to spark somebody's imagination. And it doesn't matter if you, you know, what career path you take, but actually the skills that you learn being within your community in a nurturing environment, getting on a stage, you know, we've been to many shows, Neil, haven't we? And we've seen six-year-olds who get up and sing a song on that stage in front of 300 people. And actually, whatever path you take in life, those skills that you're going to learn there, presentation at college, you know, in the workplace, whatever you decide, or if you go on to decide to work within the creative industries, it's a great start. And that's, we mustn't lose that. I think too often authorities have thought, this kid's from Thurrock, doesn't matter, does it? They're going to go and work in a factory or go and move out of the borough and live in London. So we don't really need to invest in them, but they're missing the point totally because you're talking about well-being. We're so aware of mental health and, you know, thank goodness nowadays. This is all part and parcel of it. Plus, it's bringing the community together.
Yeah. And Neil, what's the fight been like to try and keep these services open? I know that you used to have, you know, a standalone youth arts organisation that's closed. You used to have the Royal Opera House come and do performances here. That's been cut. Do you feel like things are being slowly whittled away, the things that bring joy to the people in this area?
I do. And I think there's a problem in so much as the council really don't understand that people are, they don't need to be served as such by the council, but they need to be supported to take control for themselves. And that's the whole premise of what we're trying to do here. We're trying to enable the people to say, actually, it's your taxes over the years that have paid for this building. It's already yours. You can take it over and run it for your purpose, so by the people, for the people. And I think the council then takes a back seat in that. And up to now, there's been a bit of a thing where the council is somehow in control, the mighty council. But actually, since their £1 billion debt, et cetera, and the terrible things that have happened here, the reality is that people are saying, well, actually, maybe we could do this better. So, for example, at the weekend, there was a big problem with some roadworks in one of the little villages around here called East Tilbury. And the council were just not listening to the fact that the road barriers were causing a big problem on a certain road. And over the weekend, someone removed them. And actually, they were fine. The people could move about. You know, that was absolutely fine. There's a bus service being cut. So we have worse bus service than exists in the Outer Hebrides.
Wow.
Let's just think about this. We're within half an hour of London and you can't get a bus. So when they stop that bus to that village, what some of the people did, if they've written their own report suggesting the route that it could take, where the money would come from. And it makes more sense than what the council are doing, but they're just stopping that bus service because it saves money.
Wow. Well, it's interesting what you say about the public reaction, because we were just talking to someone who's worked here on and off since he was 15. And he was saying he'd never seen such a public backlash to the decision that this place is surplus to requirement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, We've had four protests, actually, peaceful protests, and they've been incredible and they've grown every time. The last one we had November last year outside the council offices, where a decision was going to be made on this building. So we had a big protest outside. It was incredible. As I say, people from across our community singing, making their own placards, you know. It was an incredible event. We had Bloomberg there. We had the BBC. We had the ITV. It was incredible. This is Thurrock. These things don't happen here. But part of our campaign and part of our slogan is find your voice. That night, come together, together as one community and find your voice. Because if you're not happy, you need to speak up. If we think what's going on is wrong, you need to speak up. They're going to take something away from you that means a lot. We need to speak up. And absolutely, the community came out and said, and people came up to me after our second protest, actually, who weren't involved in the protest and didn't actually know what was going on and said, this is incredible. What's going on? And I said, well, actually, we're protesting because we want to save you, you know, your Thames side. And we're, this is amazing. I've never seen people protesting in Thurrock before. And this is, it was overwhelming because you saw the community coming together and it very, very special. And what we can't lose.
And do you think that's why, Neil? Do you think it's just because it's that one step too far for the people of Thurrock to take away something like this?
I believe it is. I mean, there's a reality that the people of Thurrock, as I told you earlier, there's something called the Thurrock Shrug, where they've just accepted things done to them. And what they actually realised, I think, lots of the children that I spoke to there, I was talking to them about maybe you could become a councillor one time. Maybe you could stand for election. In a democracy, you can stand up and your voice can be heard. And that's what we're saying to you here. And they were actually, lots of those young people, I think, will remember that as their first ever protest, that actually things don't have to be done this way. So I just mentioned the bus cuts, for example. Well, recently I did a visit to Dunkirk. It's a long story. It was in memory of my granddad who escaped from there years ago in the war. So I went to Dunkirk. I sailed to Dunkirk with a friend who took me on his boat. I had a fantastic time, but we had to get a taxi. And we were talking about buses. And we said, well, there seems to be, you know, quite regular bus service here and they look very modern buses. What's the deal? And the woman, the taxi driver, my French is awful, I won't try and repeat it, but the taxi driver basically said, they're free. So you don't have to pay a single fare on a bus. And of course, being English, I was going, that's amazing. Well, the council don't pay for the buses. And she said, in French, she said, what you need is a revolution.
And so does Thurrock.
Absolutely. Peaceful.
Yes, yes, yes. Let's not incite a revolt.
Not at all. Peaceful protest.
Richard, I want to bring you in here because you've been patiently listening to this conversation.
Very interesting.
Yes.
And we want the well-being revolution.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yes.
You heard it here first. Could you briefly flesh out, first of all, so that we understand the work that you do, what the World Happiness Report does?
Well, the World Happiness Report is an amazing survey of well-being in every country in the world, conducted actually by Gallup. And the question is, essentially, how satisfied are you with your life? And this simple question gives really very, very meaningful answers. For example, it's one of the best predictors of when you're going to die, of your productivity, of how you will vote, whether you will vote for the existing government. So we are very, very keen that this question become the concept that we have of how our society is progressing. Are people becoming more satisfied with their lives? And also, it should be the criterion for government. Is the government policies, are they the best to help people to have lives which are satisfying, fulfilling, and enjoyable? So from this survey, of course, you see which countries do well, especially the Scandinavian countries, do very well. They probably don't have to close their museums and libraries because they accept a higher tax rate as part of their civic participation. They give in order to receive.
Yes. And in your most recent book, Wellbeing, you break down the concept into seven subcategories: physical health, mental health, family and social relationships, work, income, physical environment, good government, values, and genes. Would it be fair to say that having a government that prioritises individual well-being could influence most of these?
It would influence all of those. But of course, the basic thing which follows from what I just said is that we should judge everything, including some things you didn't mention, like road building, for example. We should judge these things against the standard of how much they contribute to people's well-being. And, you know, there are genuine questions to be asked There's always shortage of money. Would we do better to spend a bit more of that money on child mental health or on another road? These are the questions which should be at the heart of government. And I'm very pleased that Keir Starmer has said that he wants policies to be judged by their effects on well-being as well as on income. I think it's a very, very important statement that will help us to move towards the well-being revolution. If that becomes the way in which politicians think and civil servants do their work, that's the purpose of government, to improve the well-being of the people.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Talking of Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, it really struck me that in his speech to the most recent annual conference for the party, he actually mentioned how cost of living crisis and other such things have been whittling away at the joy in life. So he mentioned going fishing or spending quiet time with your family. And it struck me because it's been a long time since I've heard a prominent politician in the UK talk in those terms. And I wonder if you agree with me, Richard, do you think it's sort of fallen a bit out of fashion talking about happiness? I know David Cameron actually, you know, flirted with the idea of measuring well-being.
Well, it's the basic, the most important idea that has defined the modern age. You know, in the Middle Ages, you were seeking happiness in the next world. And in the 18th century, people dared to say, no, what we want is happiness in this world. And we want a society in which people contribute to the happiness of other people and themselves. And we judge the society by how happy the people in it are. So it's not an idea which comes and goes. It's a basic central idea in modern Western civilization. What has made it so much more feasible as an objective is the new science of well-being, which has developed over the last 30 or 40 years. So we know so much more of how important different things are to people's happiness. And of course, the ranking that you get from the study of the science of happiness is very similar, actually, to if you ask people questions about what are the things that you most worry about in your daily life. It's always first the health and mental health, physical health of your family is always first. Then your social relationships, especially at work and in the family, and then your income. So it's really important that when we're thinking about social services, we're thinking about community, as our friends have just been saying, is a very important part of our system of relationships. And we need to give it proper weight when we're thinking about priorities for public expenditure. But as I say, there is something very odd going on in our country about our attitude to taxation, quite different from in Scandinavian countries. The fact is that as we become richer, the crucial need for income becomes less extreme relative to the things which we value, as I said, so highly, namely health and mental health and our relationships, including in the community. So we've got to stop saying it's shocking that our tax share is the highest it's ever been. Of course, our general living standard is as high as it's ever been. And that means that increasingly we should want to be buying the things that require public money, like community services. So I would say that is the crucial new debate. It's not easy to have it before an election, but I mean, you certainly need to have it after an election.
Absolutely. And I wonder, did you come across any of that frustration when you were advising the new Labour government, you know, obviously it was a different economic context, but still the preoccupations with, you know, what should be spent, how much should be taxed, balancing the books, that kind of accountant mindset is still very much there in the Treasury over the years.
Yes, but I think that something has changed in the Treasury, which is actually very important. And there's something called the Green Book, which is the rules that departments have to follow when making a case for spending money. And that now includes impacts on well-being, which it hasn't until recently. So I think we're seeing, because of the science of well-being, which is becoming known in the civil service, we are seeing a change in approach, which I think needs to be developed further, you know, under the next government. But we shouldn't think of the civil servants as a block. I think we can get the civil service to do what is in Labour's policies if we come to power, and that is to put the people's well-being absolutely at the top.
Thank you. And I want to bring Sam and Neil back in here. I wonder if you take any encouragement, actually, from what Richard's been saying. Yes, we are at this odd juncture in our politics at the moment in terms of constant talk about the tax burden, etc. But again, you know, he spoke about the progress that has been made and the actual acknowledgement of well-being within the civil service. So is that something that encourages you, Sam?
It does. And that needs to filter through to local councils and to local areas as well. I totally agree with everything that Richard said. And, you know, for us, with our battle that we have here, if you're talking about the Thameside, it is about a culture. It is for everybody, every part of our community. So many skills are learned from the community, from being together, from growing together. You know, I'm a theatre buff, so that's my love. And I have been since a child. But that's in our DNA. You know, as human beings, that's what we need, and it brings everybody together. So I think that's perfect. I think that what Richard was saying is absolutely true as well. You're talking about infrastructure, and that's what we're lacking. And that's, I think, sounds from what Richard's saying, very promising, that we need to rebuild that infrastructure that I think we did have, you know, many years ago, but that's been taken away because it's about budgets, about bottom lines, about, you know, take, cut, cut, cut. And we're not left with very much. And obviously our battle here is to save this building for our community, for it to be run for the community by the community. So I think that's very important for all of us. And I think people are very much more aware, obviously, after COVID and the recent years about mental well-being, you know, mental health. And I find that very uplifting too, because we're all becoming more socially aware beings. And that's really, really important for our communities to survive. You know, we kind of think of the country, and I know we're talking about Keir Starmer and politics, etc., but you've got to come right down to the basics. And this is where our communities begin and where we live, where the children come out of that.
Can I say that I think that the idea that you just put, social infrastructure, is an incredibly important phrase in this discussion, because it's so easy for people to build buildings and roads and things you can touch. But it's a social infrastructure which has such a huge impact on how people actually feel day to day in their lives.
Absolutely. And I think that's been lost recently. And we're lost for a number of years, and we need to build on that.
For us, as a social enterprise, one of the things we talk about is we describe community as an experience, not a location. That's what we teach people. And part of that as well is we talk a lot about moving people from passive recipients of care to active citizens in control. And that's the different relationship we want people to have with local government and central government. I'm not a receiver of your goods. I'm actually an active citizen in control. And we teach that to people with learning disabilities. And we teach everyone that it's actually about people and purpose. What's your connection to people and what's your purpose? And the arts and culture bring us together. And together we become strong and we can have a well-being experience. Interestingly, Richard, my question to you is the Z generation. I've been interviewing people for probably, scarily, 35 years now. And the generation that are coming through now, we can't pay massive wages, which is the care profession. It's just what it is. But there's lots of questions always into about how we support people with their mental health. What do we do about people's well-being? Because it seems to me that people are developing, the younger generation, the Z generation in particular, are saying, I'm not going to work for you. I'm not going to stay here and be here for you. unless your values and beliefs are the same as mine, which features well-being.
I think it's wonderful that you are starting off with the question of what is your purpose? Because, I mean, going back to this fundamental philosophical question, you know, if the best state of the world is one where people are enjoying their life and are happy, our moral obligation is obviously to try and produce the best state of the world, which is to create happiness. I mean, we should, your purpose in life should be to be a creator of happiness for others, especially, but also for yourself, especially through helping other people. And I think unless we can somehow get away from this terrible philosophy that your purpose in life is to be more successful than other people, which is something which can't be increased. The amount of success can't be increased. Everyone who rises, somebody else has to fall in that scheme of things. Get to a positive-sum philosophy where you get your happiness from making other people happier, and so we all progress together. I think that is completely essential.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Richard, because it brings me on to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is often from our politicians, what you hear is this preoccupation with what you just mentioned, social mobility. Economic inactivity is a big thing that they're preoccupied with at the moment. People who are out of work could be working. And productivity, that's something that we hear a lot about. You know, this could increase productivity. But we rarely hear, other than that snippet from the Starmer speech that I mentioned earlier in the conversation, them talk about what the purpose that we've just been talking about, the real things that people value in life. And I wonder, Sam and Neil, I know you're talking in a local context, but I wonder if you'd like to hear a bit more of that from the people who are making these policies that ultimately, you know, influence the policy environment that your council is operating.
Yeah, I'd like that to be a two-way street. I'd like to hear more from the top, and I'd like them to listen. There's something, Neil, I'm going to take Hestelia's line now. It's a brilliant line. We've got two ears and one mouth. And that's the right, would you say that's the right ratio?
I was born with two ears and one mouth for a reason. We need to listen more than we speak.
Yeah. So again, that's a two-way street. So yes, I'm desperate to hear more from above. I want that to filter down, but I also want from the grassroots for it to come up, to for people to listen, to reach out, to listen. Communities aren't built like that. Communities aren't built out of money. They are built from people. And that's really, really important. So that's definitely a two-way street, I think.
This is sometimes referred to by politicians. I think we know they do talk about civic virtue. They do talk about rights implying responsibility. Somebody has a right. Somebody's got to be responsible for providing it. If I could do a bit of advertising, I think civic organizations, including one which I'm involved with called Action for Happiness, have an incredibly important role in spreading the idea that your purpose is to practice civic virtue.
Richard, as I mentioned earlier, it's been 10 years since the first World Happiness Report was published. What kind of progress have you seen in this time, particularly in the context of Britain? I mean, I feel like we often hear phrases like crumbling Britain and broken Britain, particularly since the austerity years. But then you've said that there's been some progress as well. So, you know, are things getting better or worse here?
Well, some better and some worse, isn't it? I mean, all our public services are struggling at the moment, not just the NHS, schools, the courts, the prison, the struggle everywhere. I think that, you know, we're still paying the price of austerity, and that is very sad. The worst thing actually is hardly ever talked about, which is what's happened to our young people who don't go to university. Further education beyond 18 is half of what it was. Apprenticeships are way down from their previous peak. I think a new deal for young people who don't go to university is one of the most obvious things which is needed. So all of those are problem areas. I think there are a lot of positive things going on, though. I think people, individuals, are becoming much more psychologically aware. Many of them are adopting practices to improve their own mental well-being, mindfulness, yoga, etc. I think people are more tolerant, they're more open, if you actually look at the Office of National Statistics surveys of whether people say they're satisfied with their lives, which started in 2011, which was admittedly a rather low year, just after the financial crash. But those answers improved steadily up till the COVID pandemic. I don't think it's right to say that sort of life in Britain has sort of deteriorated in some fundamental way. I think our social services have been suffering, and people have suffered as a result of that. But other good things have happened.
Yes, I think that's a really good outline. And Sam and Neil, before I let you go, Thameside is still open. There's still stuff going on in this building.
Thameside is still open. In fact, I'm coming here to see 39 Steps tonight in the theatre because it's their opening night and it runs for the next 3 or 4 days. So, yeah, so there's lots going on here. You met Daryl earlier with Arts, you know, Arts Outburst and Arts Creation. You know, there's lots going on. But we fought incredibly hard from that. As I said to you before, they shut the doors after COVID and they put a sign on saying, ring this number if you wanted somebody to come to the front door. This is a public building. They shut the cafe. It was bustling. Young mums, you know, that probably stuck inside four walls with a little baby, got the opportunity to come and have a cup of coffee and talk to other mums. It's a lifeline for many, many people. Yeah. We've got lots of organisations, Neil included, is based within the building. There's the library, there's the museum, but we have to keep continuing to fight to save this place for community because what it represents and what it means to so many people.
The wellbeing revolution starts here.
Right in Thurrock.
Thank
you heard it here first.
Thank you very much, everyone. This was a really excellent conversation. I really enjoyed all of your insights. Thanks for your time. I'm back here in the New Statesman studio with Armando, who's actually been working on a different play, separate from our friends at the Thameside,
which
is why you couldn't join us.
Which is why, you know, scheduling clash. And also cuts means that we could only afford one train ticket.
Austerity at the New Statesman.
Fascinating. And I'm sorry I wasn't there because my whole bugbear for ages has been, why do we look down on things like culture, well-being, the arts, the creative industries in the UK, as I keep banging on about, generates more money for the British economy than the oil industry and the car industry put together. So we should be celebrating it. And yet here we are again, seeing people have to fight to save it. It's always the first on the list of things that gets cut. And I think the interesting thing that was thrown up there was actually, as they all said, the better, the more well-being you have, the more you feel good about yourself and about your community, actually it does affect the economy. It does affect productivity. You know, if you feel better about yourself, then you feel more positive about how you work and what work you do and the hours you put in and the satisfaction you get from it. And I don't think enough people have actually gone and quantified economically what feeling good actually does for us and does for society.
Yeah, and I think there's been sort of attempts over the years. It's one of those perennial things that keeps coming back. I think David Cameron talked about happiness index. Yeah. You know, the Scottish government tries to measure well-being in that way, but it never seems to supersede GDP in terms of what's most important.
Yes, and as you kept referring to, you know, the accountancy culture that now is, in that all of politics has now been reduced to, you know, a balance sheet.
Yeah.
And obviously, healthy resources is always important. But the fact that that has now become the be-all and end-all is, I think, you know, it is a subjective judgment that has been taken. And it's actually one that is promulgated by the media as well, in that, you know, it will be the political correspondent who looks at the budget implications and business leaders, you know, on the Today programme are not really challenged, as in, you know, are you any good at your job?
Yeah, exactly. You'll have city economists on who have a certain view of what the economy should be. Yeah. But you don't have, you know, I mean, I thought it was interesting that in Thurrock, since it's gone bankrupt, council tax has gone up 10%. The bins are emptied far less often. And there's going to be all sorts of other cuts and charges, like parking charges will go up. But what the community has been most affected by is the idea that Thameside could close. So it's clear that, you know, while there are immediate day-to-day budgetary issues for people from the cuts to their council, it is these things that make life a little brighter that matter the most.
And as we've been charting across, not just this series, but previous ones, there has been a pattern of national government
yeah.
cooking the books slightly by clearing their desks of certain responsibilities and giving them to local councils and regional government
yeah.
who can't afford it. So regional councils are given more and more statutory obligations on social care and mental health and so on that they can't fulfil because their budgets have been cut and therefore are forced into making these other decisions which significantly impact on people's lives.
And actually, we bumped into someone who's worked on and off at Tebeside since the age of 15, Daryl Branch. He's the director of Arts Outburst, which is a community arts organisation. He couldn't speak to us on the podcast because he was rehearsing with these young people who were doing Hamlet the musical. They were about to take it to Italy. They sounded amazing, so we thought we'd stick around and record some of their singing. You've been listening to Westminster Reimagined, a bonus series on the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and our special guest host, Armando Iannucci. Join us for the next episode of Westminster Reimagined, which will also be the last in the series, when Armando and I ask, is our system of political reporting fair and accurate? And what does this mean going into a general election? If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and don't forget to subscribe. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes. Our executive producer is Chris Stone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.